2. Key and Rose. 1. For 3 weeks, John Jake Chambers fought bravely against the madness rising inside him. During that time, he felt like the last man aboard a foundering ocean liner, working the bilge pumps for dear life, trying to keep the ship afloat until the storm ended, the skies cleared, and help could arrive. Help from somewhere. Help from anywhere. On May 31, 1977, 4 days before school ended for the summer, he finally faced up to the fact that no help was going to come. It was time to give up. Time to let the storm carry him away. The straw that broke the camel's back was his final essay in English comp. John Chambers, who was Jake to the 3 or 4 boys who were almost his friends, if his father had known this little factoid, he undoubtedly would have hit the roof, was finishing his first year at the Piper School. Although he was 11 and in the 6th grade, he was small for his age, and people meeting him for the first time often thought he was much younger. In fact, he had sometimes been mistaken for a girl until a year or so ago, when he had made such a fuss about having his hair cut short that his mother had finally relented and allowed it. With his father, of course, there had been no problem about the haircut. His father had just grinned his hard, stainless steel grin and said, "The kid wants to look like a Marine, Laurie. Good for him." To his father, he was never Jake and rarely John. To his father, he was usually just the kid. The Piper School, his father had explained to him the summer before, the bicentennial summer that had been, all bunting and flags and New York Harbor filled with tall ships, was, quite simply, the best damned school in the country for a boy your age. The fact that Jake had been accepted there had nothing to do with money, Elmer Chambers explained, almost insisted. He had been savagely proud of this fact, although even at 10, Jake had suspected it might not be a true fact, that it might really be a bunch of bullshit his father returned into a fact so he could casually drop it into the conversation at lunch or over cocktails. "My kid? Oh, he's going to Piper. Best damn school in the country for a boy his age. Money won't buy you into that school, you know. For Piper, it's brains or nothing." Jake was perfectly aware that in the fierce furnace of Elmer Chambers' mind, the gross carbon of wish and opinion was often blasted into the hard diamonds which he called facts, or, in more informal circumstances, factoids. His favorite phrase, spoken often and with reverence, was, "The fact is," and he used it every chance he got. "The fact is, money doesn't get anyone into the Piper School," his father had told him during that bicentennial summer, the summer of blue skies and bunting and tall ships, a summer which seemed golden in Jake's memory, because he had not yet begun to lose his mind, and all he had to worry about was whether or not he could cut the mustard at the Piper School, which sounded like a nest for newly hatched geniuses. "The only thing that gets you into a place like Piper is what you've got up here." Elmer Chambers had reached over his desk and tapped the center of his son's forehead with a hard, nicotine-stained finger. "Get me, kid?" Jake had nodded. It wasn't necessary to talk to his father, because his father treated everyone, including his wife, the way he treated his underlings at the TV network where he was in charge of programming and an acknowledged master of the kill. All you had to do was listen, nod in the right places, and after a while he let you go. "Good," his father said, lighting one of the 80 Camel cigarettes he smoked each and every day. "We understand each other, then. You're going to have to work your buttski off, but you can cut it. They never would have sent us this if you couldn't." He picked up the letter of acceptance from the Piper School and rattled it. There was a kind of savage triumph in the gesture, as if the letter was an animal he had killed in the jungle, an animal he would now skin and eat. "So, work hard. Make your grades. Make your mother and me proud of you. If you end the year with an A average in your courses, there's a trip to Disney World in it for you. That's something to shoot for, right, kiddo?" Jake had made his grades, A's in everything, until the last 3 weeks, that was. He had, presumably, made his mother and father proud of him, although they were around so little that it was hard to tell. Usually there was nobody around when he came home from school except for Greta Shaw, the housekeeper, and so he ended up showing his A papers to her. After that, they migrated to a dark corner of his room. Sometimes Jake looked through them and wondered if they meant anything. He wanted them to, but he had serious doubts. Jake didn't think he would be going to Disney World this summer. A average or no A average. He thought the Nut House was a much better possibility. As he walked in through the double doors of the Piper School at 8:45 on the morning of May 31st, a terrible vision came to him. He saw his father in his office at 70 Rockefeller Plaza, leaning over his desk with a Camel jutting from the corner of his mouth, talking to one of his underlings as blue smoke wreathed his head. All of New York was spread out behind and below his father, its thump and hustle silenced by two layers of thermopane glass. "The fact is, money doesn't get anyone into Sunnyvale Sanitarium," his father was telling the underling in a tone of grim satisfaction. He reached out and tapped the underling's forehead. "The only thing that gets you into a place like that is when something big time goes wrong up here in the attic. That's what happened to the kid. But he's working his goddamn buttski off, makes the best fucking baskets in the place, they tell me, and when they let him out, if they ever do, there's a trip in it for him, a trip to the way station," Jake muttered, then touched his forehead with a hand that wanted to tremble. The voices were coming back, the yelling, conflicting voices which were driving him mad. "You're dead, Jake. You were run over by a car, and you're dead. Don't be stupid. Look, see that poster? Remember the Class 1 picnic, it says. Do you think they have class picnics in the afterlife?" "I don't know, but I know you were run over by a car." "No!" "Yes. It happened on May 9th at 8:25 a.m. You died less than a minute later." "No, no, no!" "John?" He looked around, badly startled. Mr. Bessette, his French teacher, was standing there looking a little concerned. Behind him, the rest of the student body was streaming into the common room for the morning assembly. There was very little skylarking and no yelling at all. Presumably, these other students, like Jake himself, had been told by their parents how lucky they were to be attending Piper, where money didn't matter, although tuition was $22,000 a year, only your brains. Presumably, many of them had been promised trips this summer if their grades were good enough. Presumably, the parents of the lucky trip winners would even go along in some cases. Presumably, "John, are you okay?" Mr. Bessette asked. "Sure," Jake said. "Fine. I overslept a little this morning. Not awake yet, I guess." Mr. Bessette's face relaxed, and he smiled. "Happens to the best of us. Not to my dad. The master of the kiln never oversleeps." "Are you ready for your French final?" Mr. Bessette asked. "Voulez-vous faire l'examen cet après-midi?" "I think so," Jake said. In truth, he didn't know if he was ready for the exam or not. He couldn't even remember if he had studied for the French final or not. These days nothing seemed to matter much except for the voices in his head. "I want to tell you again how much I enjoyed having you this year, John. I wanted to tell your folks, too, but they missed parents' night." "They're pretty busy," Jake said. Mr. Bessette nodded. "Well, I have enjoyed you. I just wanted to say so, and that I'm looking forward to having you back for French, too, next year." "Thanks," Jake said, and wondered what Mr. Bessette would say if he added, "But I don't think I'll be taking French, too, next year, unless I can get a correspondence course delivered to my postal box at good old Sunnyvale." Joanne Franks, the school secretary, appeared in the doorway of the common room with her small silver-plated bell in her hand. At the Piper School, all bells were rung by hand. Jake supposed that if you were a parent, that was one of its charms. Memories of the little red schoolhouse and all that. He hated it himself. The sound of that little bell seemed to go right through his head. "I can't hold on much longer," he thought despairingly. "I'm sorry, but I'm losing it. I'm really, really losing it." Mr. Bessette had caught sight of Ms. Franks. He turned away, then turned back again. "Is everything all right, John? You've seemed preoccupied these last few weeks. Troubled. Is something on your mind?" Jake was almost undone by the kindness in Mr. Bessette's voice. But then he imagined how Mr. Bessette would look if he said, "Yes, something is on my mind. One hell of a nasty little factoid. I died, you see, and I went into another world, and then I died again. You're going to say that stuff like that doesn't happen, and of course you're right. And part of my mind knows you're right, but most of my mind knows that you're wrong. It did happen. I did die." If he said something like that, Mr. Bessette would be on the phone to Elmer Chambers at once. and Jake thought that Sunnyvale Sanitarium would probably look like a rescuer after all the stuff his father would have to say on the subject of kids who started having crazy notions just before finals week. Kids who did things like that couldn't be discussed over lunch or cocktails. Kids who let down the side. Jake forced himself to smile at Mr. Bissett. "I'm a little worried about exams, that's all." Mr. Bissett winked. "You'll do fine." Ms. Franks began to ring the assembly bell. Each peal stabbed into Jake's ears and then seemed to flash across his brain like a small rocket. "Come on," Mr. Bissett said. "We'll be late. Can't be late on the first day of finals week, can we?" They went in past Ms. Franks and her clashing bell. Mr. Bissett headed toward the row of seats called Faculty Choir. There were lots of cute names like that at Piper School. The auditorium was the common room. Lunch hour was outs. Seventh and eighth graders were upper boys and girls, and of course the folding chairs over by the piano, which Miss Franks would soon begin to pound as mercilessly as she rang her silver bell, was faculty choir. All part of the tradition, Jake supposed. If you were a parent who knew your kid had outs in the common room at noon, instead of just slopping up tuna surprise in the caf, you relaxed into the assurance that everything was A-okay in the education department. He slipped into a seat at the rear of the room and let the morning's announcements wash over him. The terror ran endlessly on in his mind, making him feel like a rat trapped on an exercise wheel. And when he tried to look ahead to some better, brighter time, he could see only darkness. The ship was his sanity, and it was sinking. Mr. Harley, the headmaster, approached the podium and imparted a brief exordium about the importance of finals week and how the grades they received would constitute another step upon the great road of life. He told them that the school was depending on them, he was depending on them, and their parents were depending on them. He did not tell them that the entire free world was depending on them, but he strongly implied that this might be so. He finished by telling them that bells would be suspended during finals week, the first and only piece of good news Jake had received that morning. Miss Franks, who had assumed her seat at the piano, struck an invocatory chord. The student body, 70 boys and 50 girls, each turned out in a neat and sober way that bespoke their parents' taste and financial stability, rose as one and began to sing the school song. Jake mouthed the words and thought about the place where he had awakened after dying. At first he had believed himself to be in hell, and when the man in the black hooded robe came along, he had been sure of it. Then, of course, the other man had come along, a man Jake had almost come to love. "But he let me fall. He killed me." He could feel prickly sweat breaking out on the back of his neck and between his shoulder blades. "So we hail the halls of Piper, hold its banner high. Hail to thee, our alma mater, Piper, do or die." God, what a shitty song, Jake thought. And it suddenly occurred to him that his father would love it. 2. Period 1 was English Comp, the only class where there was no final. Their assignment had been to write a final essay at home. This was to be a typed document between 1,500 and 4,000 words long. The subject Ms. Avery had assigned was My Understanding of Truth. The final essay would count as 25% of their final grade for the semester. Jake came in and took his seat in the third row. There were only 11 pupils in all. Jake remembered orientation day last September when Mr. Harley had told them that Piper had the highest teacher-to-student ratio of any fine private middle school in the East. He had popped his fist repeatedly on the lectern at the front of the common room to emphasize this point. Jake hadn't been terribly impressed, but he had passed the information along to his father. He thought his father would be impressed, and he had not been wrong. He unzipped his book bag and carefully removed the blue folder which contained his final essay. He laid it on his desk, meaning to give it a final look over, when his eye was caught by the door at the left side of the room. It led, he knew, to the cloakroom, and it was closed today because it was 70 degrees in New York and no one had a coat which needed storage. Nothing back there except a lot of brass coat hooks and a line on the wall and a long rubber mat on the floor for boots. A few boxes of school supplies, chalk, blue books, and such, were stored in the far corner. No big deal. All the same, Jake rose from his seat, leaving the folder unopened on the desk, and walked across to the door. He could hear his classmates murmuring quietly together, and the riffle of pages as they checked their own final essays for that crucial misplaced modifier or fuzzy phrase. But these sounds seemed far away. It was the door which held his attention. In the last 10 days or so, as the voices in his head grew louder and louder, Jake had become more and more fascinated with doors. All kinds of doors. He must have opened the one between his bedroom and the upstairs hallway 500 times in just the last week, and the one between his bedroom and the bathroom 1,000. Each time he did it, he felt a tight ball of hope and anticipation in his chest, as if the answer to all of his problems lay somewhere behind this door or that one, and he would surely find it eventually. But each time it was only the hall or the bathroom or the front walk or whatever. Last Thursday he had come home from school, thrown himself on his bed, and had fallen asleep. Sleep, it seemed, was the only refuge which remained to him. Except when he'd awakened 45 minutes later, he had been standing in the bathroom doorway, peering dazedly in at nothing more exciting than the toilet and the basin. Luckily, no one had seen him. Now, as he approached the cloakroom door, he felt that same dazzling burst of hope, a certainty that the door would not open on a shadowy closet containing only the persistent smells of winter, flannel, rubber, and wet wool, but on some other world where he could be whole again. Hot, dazzling light would fall across the classroom floor in a widening triangle, and he would see birds circling in a faded blue sky the color of his eyes, old jeans. A desert wind would blow his hair back and dry the nervous sweat on his brow. He would step through this door and be healed. Jake turned the knob and opened the door. Inside was only darkness and a row of gleaming brass hooks. One long-forgotten mitten lay near the stacked piles of blue books in the corner. His heart sank, and suddenly Jake felt like simply creeping into that dark room with its bitter smells of winter and chalk dust. He could move the mitten and sit in the corner under the coat hooks. He could sit on the rubber mat where you were supposed to put your boots in the wintertime. He could sit there, put his thumb in his mouth, pull his knees tight against his chest, close his eyes, and just give up. This idea, the relief of this idea, was incredibly attractive. It would be an end to the terror and confusion and dislocation. That last was somehow the worst, that persistent feeling that his whole life had turned into a funhouse mirror maze. Yet, there was deep steel in Jake Chambers, as surely as there was deep steel in Eddie and Susanna. Now it flashed out its dour blue lighthouse gleam in the darkness. There would be no giving up. Whatever was loose inside him might tear his sanity away from him in the end, but he would give it no quarter in the meantime. Be damned if he would. Never, he thought fiercely. Never! Never! When you've finished your inventory of the school supplies in the cloakroom, John, perhaps you'd care to join us, Miss Avery said from behind him in her dry, cultured voice. There was a small gust of giggles as Jake turned away from the cloakroom. Miss Avery was standing behind her desk with her long fingers tented lightly on the blotter, looking at him out of her calm, intelligent face. She was wearing her blue suit today, and her hair was pulled back in its usual bun. Nathaniel Hawthorne looked over her shoulder, frowning at Jake from his place on the wall. "Sorry," Jake muttered, and closed the door. He was immediately seized by a strong impulse to open it again, to double-check, to see if this time that other world with its hot sun and desert vistas was there. Instead, he walked back to his seat. Petra Jesserling looked at him with merry, dancing eyes. "Take me in there with you next time," she whispered. "Then you'll have something to look at." Jake smiled in a distracted way and slipped into his seat. "Thank you, John," Miss Avery said in her endlessly calm voice. Now, before you pass in your final essays, which I am sure will all be very fine, very neat, very specific, I should like to pass out the English department's short list of recommended summer reading. I will have a word to say about several of these excellent books. As she spoke, she gave a small stack of mimeographed sheets to David Surrey. David began to hand them out, and Jake opened his folder to take a final look at what he had written on the topic, My Understanding of Truth. He was genuinely interested in this, because he could no more remember writing his final essay than he could remember studying for his French final. He looked at the title page with puzzlement and growing unease. My Understanding of Truth by John Chambers was neatly typed and centered on the sheet, and that was all right. But he had, for some reason, pasted two photographs below it. One was of a door. He thought it might be the one at number 10 Downing Street in London, and the other was of an Amtrak train. They were color shots, undoubtedly culled from some magazine. Why did I do that? And when did I do it? He turned the page and stared down at the first page of his final essay, unable to believe or understand what he was seeing. Then, as understanding began to trickle through his shock, he felt an escalating sense of horror. It had finally happened. He had finally lost enough of his mind so that other people would be able to tell. Three. My Understanding of Truth by John Chambers. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. T.S. Butch Eliot. My first thought was, he lied in every word. Robert Sundance Browning. The gunslinger is the truth. Roland is the truth. The prisoner is the truth. The Lady of Shadows is the truth. The prisoner and the lady are married. That is the truth. The way station is the truth. The speaking demon is the truth. We went under the mountains, and that is the truth. There were monsters under the mountain. That is the truth. One of them had an Amoco gas pump between his legs and was pretending it was his penis. That is the truth. Roland let me die. That is the truth. I still love him. That is the truth. And it is so very important that you all read The Lord of the Flies, Miss Avery was saying in her clear but somehow pale voice. And when you do, you must ask yourselves certain questions. A good novel is often like a series of riddles within riddles, and this is a very good novel, one of the best written in the second half of the 20th century. So ask yourselves first what the symbolic significance of the conch shell might be. Second, far away. Far, far away. Jake turned to the second page of his final essay with a trembling hand, leaving a dark smear of sweat on the first page. When is a door not a door? When it's ajar, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. Blaine is the truth. What has four wheels and flies? A garbage truck, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. You have to watch Blaine all the time. Blaine is a pain, and that is the truth. I'm pretty sure that Blaine is dangerous, and that is the truth. What is black and white and red all over? A blushing zebra, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. I want to go back, and that is the truth. I have to go back, and that is the truth. I'll go crazy if I don't go back, and that is the truth. I can't go home again unless I find a stone, a rose, a door, and that is the truth. Choo-choo, and that is the truth. Choo-choo, 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 I am afraid. That is the truth. Choo-choo. Jake looked up slowly. His heart was beating so hard that he saw a bright light like the afterimage of a flashbulb dancing in front of his eyes, a light that pulsed in and out with each titanic thud of his heart. He saw Miss Avery handing his final essay to his mother and father. Mr. Bassett was standing beside Miss Avery, looking grave. He heard Miss Avery say in her clear, pale voice, "Your son is seriously ill. If you need proof, just look at this final essay." "John hasn't been himself for the last 3 weeks or so," Mr. Bassett added. "He seems frightened some of the time, and dazed all of the time. Not quite there, if you see what I mean. Je pense que Jean est fou, comprenez-vous?" "Miss Avery again, do you perhaps keep certain mood-altering prescription drugs in the house where John might have access to them?" Jake didn't know about mood-altering drugs, but he knew his father kept several grams of cocaine in the bottom drawer of his study desk. His father would undoubtedly think he had been into it. "Now let me say a word about Catch-22," Miss Avery said from the front of the room. "This is a very challenging book for sixth and seventh grade students, but you will nonetheless find it entirely enchanting if you open your minds to its special charm. You may think of this novel, if you like, as a comedy of the surreal." "I don't need to read something like that," Jake thought. "I'm living something like that, and it's no comedy." He turned over to the last page of his final essay. There were no words on it. Instead, he had pasted another picture to the paper. It was a photograph of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. He had used a crayon to scribble it black. The dark, waxy lines looped and swooped in lunatic coils. He could remember doing none of this. Absolutely none of it. Now he heard his father saying to Mr. Bassett, "Foo! Yes, he's definitely foo. A kid who'd fuck up his chance at a school like Piper has to be foo, wouldn't you say? Well, I can handle this. Handling things is my job. Sunnyvale's the answer. He needs to spend some time in Sunnyvale, making baskets and getting his shit back together. Don't you worry about our kid, folks. He can run, but he can't hide." Would they actually send him away to the nut hatch if it started to seem that his elevator no longer went all the way to the top floor? Jake thought the answer to that was a big you bet. No way his father was going to put up with a loony around the house. The name of the place they put him in might not be Sunnyvale, but there would be bars on the windows, and there would be young men in white coats and crepe-soled shoes prowling the halls. The young men would have big muscles and watchful eyes and access to hypodermic needles full of artificial sleep. "They'll tell everybody I went away," Jake thought. The arguing voices in his head were temporarily stilled by a rising tide of panic. "They'll say I'm spending the year with my aunt and uncle in Modesto, or in Sweden as an exchange student, or repairing satellites in outer space. My mother won't like it. She'll cry, but she'll go along. She has her boyfriends. And besides, she always goes along with what he decides. Me... He felt a shriek welling up in his throat, and pressed his lips tightly together to hold it in. He looked down again at the wild black scribbles snarled across the photograph of the Leaning Tower and thought, "I have to get out of here. I have to get out right now." He raised his hand. "Yes, John, what is it?" Miss Avery was looking at him with the expression of mild exasperation she reserved for students who interrupted her in mid-lecture. "I'd like to step out for a moment, if I may," Jake said. This was another example of Piper speak. Piper students did not ever have to take a leak or tap a kidney or, God forbid, drop a load. The unspoken assumption was that Piper students were too perfect to create waste byproducts in their tastefully silent glides through life. Once in a while, someone requested permission to step out for a moment, and that was all. Miss Avery sighed. "Must you, John?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"All right. Return as soon as possible."
"Yes, Miss Avery."
He closed the folder as he got up, took hold of it, then reluctantly let go again. No good. Miss Avery would wonder why he was taking his final essay to the toilet with him. He should have removed the damning pages from the folder and stuffed them in his pocket before asking for permission to step out. Too late now. Jake walked down the aisle toward the door, leaving his folder on the desk and his book bag lying beneath it.
"Hope everything comes out all right, Chambers," David Surrey whispered and snickered into his hand.
"Still your restless lips, David," Miss Avery said, clearly exasperated now, and the whole class laughed.
Jake reached the door leading to the hall, and as he grasped the knob, that feeling of hope and surety rose in him again.
"This is it. Really it. I'll open the door and the desert sun will shine in. I'll feel that dry wind on my face. I'll step through and never see this classroom again."
He opened the door, and it was only the hallway on the other side. But he was right about one thing, just the same. He never saw Miss Avery's classroom again. 4. He walked slowly down the dim, wood-paneled corridor, sweating lightly. He walked past classroom doors he would have felt compelled to open if not for the clear glass windows set in each one. He looked into Mr. Bissett's French 2 class and Mr. Knopf's introduction to geometry class. In both rooms, the pupils sat with pencils in hand and heads bowed over open blue books. He looked into Mr. Harley's spoken arts class and saw Stan Dorfman, one of those acquaintances who are not quite friends, beginning his final speech. Stan looked scared to death, but Jake could have told Stan he didn't have the slightest idea what fear, real fear, was all about.
"I died." "No, I didn't." "Did too." "Did not." "Did." "Didn't."
He came to a door marked Girls. He pushed it open, expecting to see a bright desert sky and a blue haze of mountains on the horizon. Instead, he saw Belinda Stevens standing at one of the sinks, looking into the mirror above the basin and squeezing a pimple on her forehead.
"Jesus Christ, do you mind?" she asked.
"Sorry, wrong door. I thought it was the desert."
"What?"
But he had already let the door go, and it was swinging shut on its pneumatic elbow. He passed the drinking fountain and opened the door marked Boys. This was it. He knew it, was sure of it. This was the door which would take him back. 3 urinals gleamed spotlessly under the fluorescent lights. A tap dripped solemnly into a sink. That was all. Jake let the door close. He walked on down the hall, his heels making firm little clicks on the tiles. He glanced into the office before passing it and saw only Ms. Franks. She was talking on the telephone, swinging back and forth in her swivel chair and playing with a lock of her hair. The silver-plated bell stood on the desk beside her. Jake waited until she swiveled away from the door and then hurried past. 30 seconds later, he was emerging into the bright sunshine of a morning in late May.
"I've gone truant," he thought.
Even his distraction did not keep him from being amazed at this unexpected development. "When I don't come back from the bathroom in 5 minutes or so, Miss Avery will send somebody to check. And then they'll know. They'll all know that I've left school, gone truant." He thought of the folder lying on his desk.
"They'll read it and they'll think I'm crazy. Foo. Sure they will. Of course. Because I am."
Then another voice spoke. It was, he thought, the voice of the man with the bombardier's eyes, the man who wore the 2 big guns slung low on his hips. The voice was cold, but not without comfort. "No, Jake," Roland said, "you're not crazy. You're lost and scared, but you're not crazy, and need fear neither your shadow in the morning striding behind you nor your shadow at evening rising to meet you. You have to find your way back home, that's all."
"But where do I go?"
Jake whispered. He stood on the sidewalk of 56th Street between Park and Madison, watching the traffic bolt past. A city bus snored by, laying a thin trail of acrid blue diesel smoke.
"Where do I go? Where's the fucking door?"
But the voice of the gunslinger had fallen silent. Jake turned left, in the direction of the East River, and began to walk blindly forward. He had no idea where he was going, no idea at all. He could only hope his feet would carry him to the right place, as they had carried him to the wrong one not long ago. Five. It had happened 3 weeks earlier. One could not say it all began 3 weeks earlier, because that gave the impression that there had been some sort of progression. And that wasn't right. There had been a progression to the voices, to the violence with which each insisted on its own particular version of reality. But the rest of it had happened all at once. He left home at 8 o'clock to walk to school. He always walked when the weather was good, and the weather this May had been absolutely fine. His father had left for the network, his mother was still in bed, and Mrs. Greta Shaw was in the kitchen drinking coffee and reading her New York Post. "Goodbye, Greta," he said. "I'm going to school now." She raised a hand to him without looking up from the paper. "Have a good day, Johnny. All according to routine. Just another day in the life." And so it had been for the next 1,500 seconds. Then everything had changed forever. He idled along, book bag in one hand, lunch sack in the other, looking in the windows. 720 seconds from the end of his life as he had always known it, he paused to look in the window of Brendio's, where mannequins dressed in fur coats and Edwardian suits stood in stiff poses of conversation. He was thinking only of going bowling that afternoon after school. His average was 158, great for a kid who was only 11. His ambition was to someday be a bowler on the pro tour, and if his father had known this little factoid, he also would have hit the roof. Closing in now, closing in on the moment when his sanity would be suddenly eclipsed. He crossed 39th, and there were 400 seconds left. Had to wait for the walk light at 41st, and there were 270. Paused to look in the novelty shop on the corner of 5th and 42nd, and there were 190. And now, with just over 3 minutes left in his ordinary life, Jake Chambers walked beneath the unseen umbrella of that force which Roland called Ka-Tet. An odd, uneasy feeling began to creep over him. At first he thought it was a feeling of being watched, and then he realized it wasn't that at all, or not precisely that. He felt that he had been here before, that he was reliving a dream he had mostly forgotten. He waited for the feeling to pass, but it didn't. It grew stronger, and now began to mix with a sensation he reluctantly recognized as terror. Up ahead, on the near corner of 5th and 43rd, a black man in a Panama hat was setting up a pretzel and soda cart. "He's the one that yells, 'Oh my God, he's killed,'" Jake thought. Approaching the far corner was a fat lady with a Bloomingdale's bag in her hand. "She'll drop the bag and put her hands to her mouth and scream. The bag will split open. There's a doll inside the bag. It's wrapped in a red towel. I'll see this from the street, from where I'll be lying in the street with my blood soaking into my pants and spreading around me in a pool." Behind the fat woman was a tall man in a gray nailhead worsted suit. He was carrying a briefcase. "He's the one who vomits on his shoes. He's the one who drops his briefcase and throws up on his shoes. What's happening to me?" Yet his feet carried him numbly forward toward the intersection, where people were crossing in a brisk, steady stream. Somewhere behind him, closing in, was a killer priest. He knew this, just as he knew that the priest's hands would in a moment be outstretched to push. But he could not look around. It was like being locked in a nightmare where things simply had to take their course. 53 seconds left now. Ahead of him, the pretzel vendor was opening a hatch in the side of his cart. "He's going to take out a bottle of Yoo-Hoo," Jake thought. "Not a can, but a bottle. He'll shake it up and drink it all at once." The pretzel vendor brought out a bottle of Yoo-Hoo, shook it vigorously, and spun off the cap. 40 seconds left. Now the light will change. White walk went out. Red don't walk began to flash rapidly on and off.
And somewhere, less than half a block away, a big blue Cadillac was now rolling toward the intersection of 5th and 43rd. Jake knew this, just as he knew the driver was a fat man wearing a hat almost the exact same blue shade as his car.
"I'm going to die!"
He wanted to scream this aloud to the people walking heedlessly all around him, but his jaws were locked shut. His feet swept him serenely onward toward the intersection. The don't walk sign stopped flashing and shone out its solid red warning. The pretzel vendor tossed his empty Yoo-hoo bottle into the wire trash basket on the corner. The fat lady stood on the corner across the street from Jake, holding her shopping bag by the handles. The man in the nailhead suit was directly behind her. Now there were 18 seconds left.
"Time for the toy truck to go by," Jake thought.
Ahead of him, a van with a picture of a happy jumping jack and the words Tooker's Wholesale Toys printed on the side swept through the intersection, jolting up and down in the potholes. Behind him, Jake knew, the man in the black robe was beginning to move faster, closing the gap, now reaching out with his long hands. Yet he could not look around, as you couldn't look around in dreams when something awful was gaining on you.
"Run! And if you can't run, sit down and grab hold of a no parking sign. Don't just let it happen."
But he was powerless to stop it from happening. Ahead, on the edge of the curb, was a young woman in a white sweater and a black skirt. To her left was a young Chicano guy with a boombox. A Donna Summer disco tune was just ending. The next song, Jake knew, would be Dr. Love by Kiss.
"They're going to move apart."
Even as the thought came, the woman moved a step to her right. The Chicano guy moved a step to his left, creating a gap between them. Jake's traitor feet swept him into the gap. 9 seconds now. Down the street, bright May sunshine twinkled on a Cadillac hood ornament. It was, Jake knew, a 1976 Sedan DeVille. 6 seconds. The caddy was speeding up. The light was getting ready to change, and the man driving the DeVille, the fat man in the blue hat with the feathers stuck jauntily in the brim, meant to scat through the intersection before it could. 3 seconds. Behind Jake, the man in black was lunging forward. On the young man's boombox, "Love to Love You, Baby" ended, and "Dr. Love" began. 2. The Cadillac changed to the lane nearest Jake's side of the street and charged down on the intersection, its killer grill snarling. 1. Jake's breath stopped in his throat. None.
"Ah!"
Jake cried as a hand struck him firmly in the back, pushing him into the street, pushing him out of his life. Except there were no hands. He reeled forward, nevertheless, hands flailing at the air, his mouth a dark O of dismay. The Chicano guy with the boombox reached out, grabbed Jake's arm, and hauled him backward.
"Look out, little hero," he said. "That traffic turned you into bratwurst."
The Cadillac floated by. Jake caught a glimpse of the fat man in the blue hat peering out through the windshield, and then it was gone. That was when it happened. That was when he split down the middle and became two boys. One lay dying in the street. The other stood here on the corner, watching in dumb, stricken amazement as Don't Walk turned to walk again, and people began to cross around him just as if nothing had happened. As, indeed, nothing had.
"I'm alive!"
Half of his mind rejoiced, screaming with relief.
"Dead!"
The other half screamed back.
"Dead in the street! They're all gathering around me, and the man in black who pushed me is saying, 'I am a priest, let me through.'"
Waves of faintness rushed through him and turned his thoughts to billowing parachute silk. He saw the fat lady approaching, and as she passed, Jake looked into her bag. He saw the bright blue eyes of a doll peeping above the edge of a red towel, just as he had known he would. Then she was gone. The pretzel vendor was not yelling, "Oh my God, he's killed!" He was continuing to set up for the day's business while he whistled the Donna Summer tune that had been playing on the Chicano guy's radio. Jake turned around, looking wildly for the priest who was not a priest. He wasn't there. Jake moaned.
"Snap out of it! What's wrong with you?"
He didn't know. He only knew that he was supposed to be lying in the street right now, getting ready to die, while the fat woman screamed and the guy in the nailhead worsted suit threw up and the man in black pushed through the gathering crowd. And in part of his mind, that did seem to be happening.
The faintness began to return. Jake suddenly dropped his lunch sack to the pavement and slapped himself across the face as hard as he could. A woman on her way to work gave him a queer look. Jake ignored her. He left his lunch lying on the sidewalk and plunged into the intersection, also ignoring the red "don't walk" light, which had begun to stutter on and off again. It didn't matter now. Death had approached and then passed by without a second glance. It hadn't been meant to happen that way, and on the deepest level of his existence he knew that. But it had. Maybe now he would live forever. The thought made him feel like screaming all over again.